Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn about the Great Inversion, how the roles and the people of America's cities and suburbs are reversing themselves. In fact, in many American cities today, young adults and affluent retirees are moving to the central city. And in turn, the immigrants, the less affluent, lower middle class, are now moving to the suburbs. While this is most prominent in our more mature cities along the East Coast, even younger car-dependent cities are seeing this demographic shift to a lesser extent, including Tulsa. My guest today is the longtime executive editor of Governing magazine and urbanologist Alan Ehrenhalt. He spent 21 years at Governing, 19 as executive editor. After a three-year stint at leading Stateline, the news service of the Pew Charitable Trust, he's just returned to Governing as a contributing editor. He's the author of four books, including The Lost City and his latest, The Great Inversion and the Future of the American City. It's out in softcover from Vintage, and he joins us from the Governing offices in Washington, D.C. today on Studio Tulsa. Alan Ehrenhalt, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Your new book, The Great Inversion, really tries to quantify what you began experiencing in, say, the last 10 to 15 years as you traveled around American cities, as you write in the book. Said, I began to notice very quickly that cities were reinventing themselves, and you describe what you call this great inversion. What is the great inversion in your mind?
Well, we're used to the idea of cities being places where poor people live in the center. There's a reason why we call it the inner city. And wealthier people live out on the outskirts in suburbia of various kinds. And what I noticed over the past decade was that this pattern, which goes back to the early 20th century, was reversing itself. And the centers of cities were becoming homes for the affluent and unaffordable, really, to poorer people. And suburbs were becoming not necessarily impoverished, but homes for people trying to make it into the middle class, and particularly immigrants.
And it's interesting, I've seen this great inversion in action. All you have to do is not go to a city for about 10 years and go back, and all of a sudden you see all these incredible changes. But I like the fact that you relate this to Europe. This is sort of the European model, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, this is the way Vienna and Paris and London were 100 years ago. To be in the suburbs meant to be in the less desirable part of the area. And for the most part, these cities remain the same way. The center is also a center of affluence and high rents and high prices. And suburbs in Paris, the suburbs are where the North African immigrants live in rather squalid high-rise conditions. They don't live on the boulevards of central Paris.
Now, what has spurred this? Has it been the fact that, you know, if you're working in the central city and you're living way out, that commute is just getting worse and worse and worse? Is it a matter of saving money, with gas prices? Is it a matter of wanting to be just a part of the city is changing and it feels safer, crime is down, so as a result, you want to be where the action is?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things. I mean, I would put as one of them, the fact that central cities were the home of noxious industrial development in the last century, and they were places where it really wasn't very pleasant to live. They were noisy and crowded and smelly, and there was a reason why people wanted to move out of them as soon as they could. And now we don't have industry in central cities anymore, for the most part, and we don't have industry in cities at all to speak of.
Well, you just have to ride the L in Chicago. As you go out from downtown, you'll see this huge ring of abandoned factories for the most part. It almost looks like a war zone, and then you see poor neighborhoods, which were the old working-class neighborhoods, to service those factories, and then all of a sudden you have the first affluent suburbs.
Yeah. Well, they're still affluent suburbs. I mean, make no mistake about that, but in many cities you've got to go further out to get to them. Or you have a certain number of very affluent pre-World War II suburbs that have maintained their quality, and that certainly is true in Chicago, and it's true in most big cities. But that's a fairly small number of places.
So the fact that there's no industry near the central city now, this has made a big difference.
That's made a difference. And you made a reference to crime. I mean, if you look at crime rates, 1985 and 2010, you find major reductions in crime in almost every big city in the country. Now, there's been a lot of publicity about the murder rate in places like Chicago and Philadelphia. But the fact is that even in those places, ordinary crime has declined in the last 20 or 25 years. And the way to personalize it is to think about, if you're old enough, walking through the streets of a city in the 1970s or 1980s of a central city and worrying that the person behind you might be a mugger. The generation that's under 30 right now really doesn't think about that very much because the chances of it have declined and it isn't really something that's on their mind. Crime is not one of the major problems that people list when they're asked in polls, what are your major concerns? Crime is fairly close to the bottom of the list now. Mm. Murder rates in some places notwithstanding. And then I would add to that, and you also touched on this, the millennial generation, those people born really after the mid-1980s, have shown a clear preference, when they're asked, to live in cities and to participate in some form of urban life. And that includes those who were raised in affluent suburbs and feel that those suburbs don't provide them stimulation that they're expecting and that they desire. So I think what's key to all this is the preference of the millennial generation.
Now, this is really interesting because I've been doing this long enough to remember in the 1990s we were talking about the whole loss of community and the fact that the gated community was going to be the new future of America and that things like the Rotary Club were doomed, and they may still be, but this whole idea of a new generation longing for the community that the previous generation feared in many senses,
well,
is kind of interesting.
It is interesting, and it may be community in different ways. It probably isn't going to be the Rotary Club, but it might be Starbucks. It might be the socialization of meeting your friends at a Starbucks at the end of the day or at a local coffee shop that corresponds to Starbucks. It might be a book club. It might be any kind of meetup operation where people get to know each other, and those are mostly young people in what we call the millennial generation. Now, that doesn't mean that the cities, and I should make this clear, that what I'm talking about is an inversion, not a mass migration of tens of millions of people to the inner cities. Downtowns don't have room for that many people, even if they wanted to come. So we're still going to see modest increases in the total urban population size and city population size. But they'll be significant to transform the nature of the inner city, and in fact, it's already doing that.
I know I'm very fond when I hear stories about how Washington, D.C. has changed. I remember going to a restaurant sort of on a fringe neighborhood. There was actually a burned-out car in the street, and then I go back to the city 5 years ago, and it looks like Disneyland.
The hottest neighborhood on a Friday or Saturday night in Washington, D.C. for young people is the 14th Street corridor, which is where the riots occurred in 1968. Until 10 years ago, nobody had any reason to go there. And that's become a hot area, and it's getting expensive to live there.
Yeah.
That's been a remarkable turnaround. There's also been an enormous change in racial demographics in places like D.C. and Atlanta. D.C. was about two-thirds African-American in 1970. It's now less than 50% African-American. So what you've seen is a movement inward of affluent whites, some of them from the suburbs, some coming from other parts of the country, and a move of lower middle class and working class African-American families to the suburbs, joined by immigrants from other countries.
Now, one of the things, you know, that fueled the growth out to the suburbs was, you know, white flight. It was about maintaining racial divisions during the post-war period. Are these new affluent downtown growing residential areas still have those sort of racial segregation, or is it more a symptom of socioeconomic class? You have the money to move downtown, you want to be a part of this community, and it tends to be diverse by ethnic composition and racial composition, but maybe a little more inclusive by socioeconomic.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, we've made great progress since 1960 in racially integrating the center of American cities. So middle class and more affluent minorities live in these inner cities and are perfectly comfortable in living in them. What we still have is class segregation, so that you have neighborhoods in downtowns that poorer people can't afford, and there just isn't much housing for them, and they are looking for it in the suburbs. And that's why you find, particularly in most inner suburbs, a major shift and an increase in poverty between 2000 and 2010.
Yeah, most of our American cities, still social class wants to live with social class, where sometimes in Europe and in some of our older cities, you'll see really a more integrated socioeconomic composition.
You'll see it more in other parts of the world, that's true. But, you know, there's an irony to this, and that is that the greatest economic diversity was in an all-black neighborhood before World War II and shortly after, where they were segregated, and so people of all economic groups had to live there because they couldn't live in other parts of the city. And you had enormous diversity you had doctors and lawyers living next to blue-collar workers. But we wouldn't trade the current system for a system of urban segregation. When you have people limited to a fixed area, you do get class integration, but nobody would want to go back to that.
My guest today is Alan Ehrenhault. He was the executive editor of Governing Magazine for 19 years. He's now back at the magazine as a contributing editor, and he's the author of The Great Inversion and the Future of the American City. It came out last year. It's now out in a vintage softcover, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, in the book, you detail a number of American cities, beginning with Chicago and the Sheffield neighborhood. This was a working-class neighborhood, and all of a sudden it's just gentrified. And this is a story that has happened in a lot of American cities where all of a sudden, for whatever reason, capital picks a neighborhood and just lifts it up far beyond what it used to be.
Yes, that's right. That's Chicago is not the only place where that's happening. Well, I don't know enough about Tulsa to know whether you're seeing it there, but I would guess there would be some signs of it there as well.
Very nascent, just very beginnings of that in some of our working class neighborhoods just outside of the downtown area. But Tulsa, like other cities, is seeing more people living in downtown now than probably since its early youth as a city. I mean, we have to remember Tulsa is only a little over 100 years old, too.
Well, there are two other factors that relate to inner city revival. One is the presence of jobs downtown. It's hard to get a big residential population downtown unless you've got people working nearby who can either walk to work or get to work very quickly. Chicago has that. Washington has that. Atlanta has that. The other is some architectural distinction, which would lead people to choose those neighborhoods as places to live because they have a certain attractive appearance that appeals to them. And many neighborhoods of Chicago are like that, not to keep citing Chicago, but it's a city that I'm familiar with. Where there isn't any such architectural distinction, and downtown really has to be built from scratch, like in a Phoenix, for example, it's much slower to get going.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the neighborhoods you profile. The Sheffield neighborhood, for example. And since you mentioned Phoenix is in a different class. It's a city that really grew up without a real highly developed downtown at any point in its history, except maybe in its very early days. And all of a sudden now they're interested in creating a real downtown.
That's right. Well, there's a sense among a lot of Sunbelt cities, and maybe Tulsa is in this category, that they want to be a world-class city and compete with the best and most successful of cities all over the developed world, and they feel that they can't do that without a downtown that people want to come to. So in many cases, they build large public facilities, whether it's museums, libraries, stadiums, or whatever, in an attempt to make the world-class city, and then they want residents to come and live around those places and create a vibrant downtown. And that works in some cases, and it doesn't work in other cases. I think the creation of a central city neighborhood by the construction of enormous edifices is sometimes a problematic proposition.
It's hard to, a lot of times it's really hard to justify the cost of these huge public institutions, which may or may not be used. And it's sort of the Field of Dreams scenario, build it and people will come.
Yeah.
And really, everything I've read about urban planning suggests is you need to find out what the people want, then build it, because they will come once if you're building something they want. But you never know if you build it first, you never know if it's really the people will want to come to be a part of that community.
That's quite true. A stadium, for example, can be an important part of an urban revival. If you look at the stadium in Denver in what's called LODO, Lower Downtown, mm-hmm. The baseball stadium came as part and parcel of a revival that was already taking place and enhanced it. If you put down a stadium in the middle of an undeveloped area with nothing else around it to attract people, there's a good chance that that stadium will not fulfill the hopes that its builders and owners hope for.
Yeah. Here in Tulsa, we've built a large indoor arena and also a downtown ballpark. Now, the nice thing was there was lots of good bones around it, like lots of old buildings that could be rehabbed. There's a very attractive state investment rehab tax benefit for rehabbing old buildings, and this seems to have worked in our particular case. But I'm glad you mentioned Denver, because Denver is a really interesting city because it is still utterly dependent on the car. Even though they have a light rail now and they have a pretty good bus system, it's still a very much a car community.
It is.
But what's interesting about it is whether, as you're writing about, how they're trying to urbanize some of the suburbs and you create these walkable atmosphere in the suburbs. But unless you live in LODO, Lower Denver, there around the Coors Field, a lot of times it's you drive in, you park your car, and then you walk around.
Yeah, that's true of a lot of these developments. Denver is one of the cities that's taking the lead across the country in urbanizing the suburbs. It, for complicated reasons, has an oversupply of failing shopping malls out in the suburbs. And there's an attempt to create urban places, what are called village centers or lifestyle centers, on the sites of these old shopping malls, and they've done it in a few places. But as you point out, you've got to drive there. It's not urbanism in the classic sense. On the other hand, once you're in the few square blocks that make up these new urbanized developments, you can feel like you're walking around in a city, and if you live there, it can work. But it's a difficult thing to bring off.
This is one of the big issues around Western cities, too, is that these cities really were created after the invention of the car. There's no infrastructural bones, if you will, like in the eastern cities, where they were more human-sized. They've always been built around the car.
Well, that's right, and the streets are so wide that they aren't really meant for walking, and you don't, the downtown streets in a place like Salt Lake City or most western cities are enormously wide and not particularly pedestrian-friendly. And it's very hard to make that conversion if you don't have shorter, more narrow streets to begin with.
My guest today is Alan Ehrenhalta, who was the executive editor of Governing Magazine for 19 years. He recently has come back to the magazine as a contributing editor. His new book is titled The Great Inversion and the Future of the American City. It's published in softcover now by Vintage. In it, he profiles a number of American communities where you're seeing this inversion of people returning back to city centers, or in some places, city planners trying to create an inner city, even some places where it doesn't even exist, like Denver and Phoenix, for example. But let's talk about some of the mature American cities. One of the interesting things I found in the book was writing about the New York Financial District, Lower Manhattan. This is all of a sudden attracting a lot of people who want to live there. And in fact, to the point where maybe the financial district won't have much more room to grow because so many people are choosing to live in this traditional business-heavy district.
Wall Street and the Wall Street area is becoming a residential district. And that happened with great rapidity after 2001, when there was a sense that the financial district would be emptied out. And it did lose a lot of jobs and offices, but a lot of them were replaced by residential buildings, conversions of old office buildings into residences. If you walk down Wall Street on one side, the south side of Wall Street, I think it is, the full length of Wall Street from Broadway all the way to the East River, every building except the New York Stock Exchange is now a residence. It's really quite remarkable. And you walk down Wall Street on a Saturday morning and you'll see people with strollers.
Wow.
Not just a few of them. You'll see a significant population. Now, these are very affluent people, I should add. This is not your ordinary middle-class family living in Lower Manhattan. But they're kids, they're people that want to live there and, for the most part, send their kids to public schools if they can. And people who are likely to stay there as they grow older and the kids grow older. So I think the financial district's only going to take root further as a as an affluent residential neighborhood in America's largest city.
So what fuels this? Because as you write, says there are drawbacks to living there. If you want to find a Tiffany's, you'll probably find a Tiffany's, but you're not likely to find a delicatessen, a barber, a lot of the services you think that has to go with downtown living.
Well, those will have to come after the people are there, and I think that's starting to happen. There are supermarkets now in the Wall Street area. You don't have the old shoemaker that you wave to as you walk by on the sidewalk or the candy store. Those things are relics of the past, but you don't have them anywhere else either, really. Gradually, these central city neighborhoods that are attracting residents will also attract grocery stores, drug stores, the amenities that people need. There just has to be a critical mass of people to use them.
Well, there has to be a critical mass, but you know, you would assume that the real estate values are not going down in the financial districts. It could be a tough job to attract, you know, just the rents for even a ground floor drugstore might be pretty prohibitive.
Well, it just depends on how much business they can do. There's a point to that the rents are pretty prohibitive in that district, but the demand for services is also going to be growing, and my guess is that more will appear in the next few years.
The other thing that I found very interesting about this is we think of like a conversion of a neighborhood or, a gentrification taking a long, long time. This moves really fast.
It does.
That seems so counterintuitive. Why is that?
Once a place starts to get hot, so to speak, it can change in a year or two very dramatically. You mentioned leaving a city and then coming back 10 years later. But sometimes you can leave a city and come back 2 or 3 years later and you see totally different ambiance. I mentioned 14th Street in Washington, D.C. It didn't take more than a couple of years for that to become a hot restaurant and entertainment district. And a lot of these downtowns really are, other than the residences, it's restaurants and entertainment that are leading the way. And they attract people coming in from the suburbs on weekends also. But those are the easiest businesses to attract. The hardest to attract are the ones that offer retail day-to-day items. You don't find hardware stores down there very often. You don't find middle-class appealing clothing stores. You do find boutiques. So certain types of retail is attracted to these inner city districts, and other types of retail is very difficult to bring in.
As you were studying these various cities, what city struck you as the most interesting that there was sort of, you know, a lot of these cities you could say, well, here's an example in Europe, like Vienna or Paris, where you did have this, you know, Paris at one time is very analogous because, you know, central Paris was this jumble of little alleys and streets, and all of a sudden was remade in the 1870s and 1880s, and all of a sudden it has the grand boulevards, it has the affluence in the middle, and the poorer classes were moved out. But what American city really struck you as the most uniquely American story that you told in this book?
Well, that's a hard one because so many of them could qualify, but I think I would say Chicago in many ways. And Chicago is changing more rapidly than many other cities. You come back, you go away for a couple of years, and you really do see a different city in many neighborhoods. And this has been happening while Chicago has suffered some very serious problems dealing with the recession, severe budget difficulties that it's had to undergo. And, of course, the well-publicized spike in murders, which doesn't seem to detract from people wanting to live in the city. These tend to be very localized, gang-related killings, and people are moving into the city notwithstanding that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the crime is it's very segregated into specific neighborhoods.
Yes,
and the rest of the city is very safe. In fact, a lot of things. It's very interesting. The last time I was in Chicago, they were talking about the fact that downtown had become almost like a big theme park, and they were concerned they were losing their soul to becoming a theme park because of all the attractions, the parks downtown, and they were losing something essential by turning it into a theme park.
They're losing their locally owned businesses.
That's true.
When people say theme park, often what they mean is the national chains are taking over, whether it's restaurants or boutiques or other kinds of fashionable retail. And it's true, in some of the most fashionable downtowns in these cities, the local merchant has a hard time hanging on, and you're seeing fewer and fewer of them.
One last question that has to do with the Western cities, of which Tulsa is one. We have a small, dense urban core, but we are spreading out. We're mainly single family homes, much beyond these little small little nodes that are near downtown, and we're very car dependent. What is your advice for a city like that? Because everybody says, American cities need to be more dense, and that seems to be the trend at this particular point. That's what city leaders are embarking on. What does the average resident need to keep in mind about a city like that?
Well, cities that are car-dependent, particularly Western cities, are going to be car-dependent for the foreseeable future. That isn't going to change overnight, even if we have 10,000 people moving into a downtown, which is a fairly large number. The easy solution is to say these cities need transit, but the transit has to work with existing neighborhoods. And if you put in an extensive transit system in which the stops are in the middle of highways with nothing around them, the economic development impact may not be as great as you were hoping for. This is what Dallas is doing. Dallas is building, and Houston too, for that matter, are building very extensive light rail systems. And the jury is still out on whether these stops, which are really out on highways, are going to attract neighborhoods around them. I think that's going to take a very long time. So I think the most important thing to caution is patience.
And, of course, they do that because it's cheaper. You have the right-of-way there. But a transit system that goes to an existing neighborhood, that does make a powerful economic argument, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, that's what happened in Washington. We've had a lot of neighborhoods that are on the metro system that have revived partially as a result of metro being there. Whether or not people use metro to commute to work, the existence of the metro system does attract development. And that's been almost universally true in the Washington area.
Mm-hmm. The name of the book is The Great Inversion and the Future of the American City. Alan Ehrenholt, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Alan Ehrenholt is a contributing editor at Governing Magazine and the author of The Great Inversion and the Future of the American City. It's published in softcover from Vintage Paperbacks. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and you can search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Hussein Haqqani, the ambassador of Pakistan to the United States from 2008 until 2011, will give a free-to-the-public lecture at the University of Tulsa's Gussman Auditorium in the Lord and Performance Center on the TU campus Thursday evening, March 28th at 7:30 p.m. The title of this lecture is Pakistan and the United States, Future of a Reluctant Alliance. For more information on this lecture, call 918-631-2409.